Welcome back. This is Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. This is Tammy Bang-Lu with me, Manuel Criollo. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. The second segment, we're going to go and switch over to the DPRK, North Korea. And with us on the line is Sung-Hae Suh. She is the co-founder of Notato for Korean Development in New York City and the assistant professor at Scripps College. Sung-Hae, are you there?
Hi.
Hey, Sung-Hae. We've been having a little trouble, so if you might want to just speak up a bit.
Sure.
Great. And so we know Cheney has just cleared up his one-week trip to Asia, where one of his main focus was on North Korea and trying to rally, I guess, Japan, China, Russia, towards his stance on North Korea, in which he stated, I guess, again, that it was the greatest threat on the region, even linking North Korea up with terrorism and drug trafficking and you name it. We wanted to see if you can spend this next 15 minutes or so, this next segment, to take on the issue of the U.S. aggression towards North Korea. Why don't you start with the agreed frameworks and, you know, dispel some of the myths around this issue?
Well, I guess I would start by pointing out that last summer, China's Vice Foreign Minister Wang Yi identified the U.S. as the main obstacle, and that's a quote, to resolving the crisis. He talked about how the U.S. is threatening the DPRK. And I'd say that to put it into historical context, whether you talk about the U.S. nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki during World War II, or the Korean War, or the current threats in the region, it's actually, in my opinion, the U.S. that is the greatest threat to peace in Korea and the region. There was an agreement between the U.S. and the DPRK called the Agreed Framework in 1994, and according to it, the U.S. signed on to this. According to it, North Korea would dismantle its nuclear facilities, and in exchange for that, the U.S. and its allies would build alternative nuclear facilities. We have to keep in mind that in North Korea there's a huge energy crisis that, unlike some countries like Iraq, North Korea does not have oil reserves. And in order to meet its energy needs, you know, personally I'm not in favor of nuclear power anywhere, but it is one source of power to run a country. And the DPRK had developed nuclear facilities for its energy needs. Some of that nuclear facility could have been used for weapons, although we don't really know, and the U.S. was upset with this. So North Korea at that time said, okay, well, we will dismantle those nuclear facilities that could also be used for wartime as well as peacetime purposes, and in exchange, the U.S. agreed to supply heavy oil, agreed to build, along with its allies, two light water reactors. In fact, the U.S. did not do those things, and North Korea has resumed its building its own facilities because the U.S. and its allies reneged on their end of the agreed framework.
And as we know that DPRK has the right to self-determination, so they have the right to do what they need to do in order to accommodate the needs of meeting basic necessities in the region. Could you talk a little bit about, you said that with the fall of the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, a lot of the resources were gained to that. Could you give a feel for what it's like in North Korea? Because I know Notato has a program, the Korean Education Exposure Program, both to South Korea but also to North Korea, and you yourself have been there many times.
Yeah, well, in North Korea, basically, it's unmistakable. There's a huge energy crisis there. At certain times of the day, you don't always get electricity. You don't always get hot water. People need to, you know, really use alternative means of transportation like walking and bicycles. There's a lot of that. The people are very, very proud and very determined, but it's clear that there's a lot of suffering going on. There's still rationing of food going on. North Korea is still coming out of a really, really devastating famine. So, I have relatives in the North who I was able to meet, and they said it they told me about how difficult it was, but they seemed quite determined to, you know, continue on. And what I was really struck by was how people just, you know, don't complain about these things. It's part of life, and they deal with it. They see the U.S. as the main reason for their suffering. They see the embargo. They see the way the U.S. Has inhibited trade, and so forth.
What was it? You had mentioned a little bit about what you saw in North Korea on your trip there. Tell me, Notatol sends, I don't know, handfuls of young Koreans over to the DPRK to learn and to study. What's it like? I mean, oftentimes there's very little that's even spoken or known about North Korea besides what mainstream press has said, and we know what that means, right? As North Korea is the greatest threat, it's one of the axis of evil, along with, you know, Iran and Iraq, quote unquote, from the Bush administration. But what's it been like, and in your own experience, how did you feel coming out of through that experience in North Korea?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd want to say is that Notatol takes the position that people, Koreans, and everyone actually, although we focus in the Korean community, should be able to make their own decisions, should be able to see for themselves what's going on. There is such a level of media bias and blackout and just plain misunderstanding and just lack of information, both in the mainstream, on the right, on the left, everywhere, that we think it's really crucial that people, as much as possible, go and see for themselves. Talk to people and make their own decisions. And we find that what you have is a country there that's just trying to, you know, make its way in the world in the way that it chooses. And what particularly disturbs me as a Korean in the U.S. is the role that the United States is currently playing in making that difficult. Now, if North Korea really were threatening to bomb other countries or do all of these other things, that could be a different story, but it's not. You know, we see that it's actually not North Korea that is threatening other countries in the world. I guess
you said before that the Korean War is really alive in the public consciousness of the Korean people in North Korea. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think for the people in the United States, the Korean War is either unknown or it's something vague that happened ages ago. It's kind of ancient history for people in this country. But for people in North Korea, the memory is very, very much alive. I don't know if listeners know that 20% of the population of North Korea was killed during the war. It wasn't just soldiers, but it was a lot of civilians, millions of civilians who died. And every single family was touched by this. And in terms of both the family memory and also the education system, the memory of the Korean War and the fact that the country was divided, it's still something that's very, very present in people's minds. And, you know, earlier I heard Nami Lee talking about the Democratic Labor Party. I'd also point out that the Democratic Labor Party is the only one that has called for a withdrawal of the 37,000 U.S. troops that are still in South Korea and has called for a rapid reunification with the North.
Sanghae, this is Manuel Criollo from here from Voices from the Frontline. You know, can you talk a little bit about what you think are the positive pieces of the recent Yuri victory in South Korea, knowing that in many ways, again, one of the things, the reasons why we wanted to do this show is because we think it's still sort of a very positive piece in sort of the overall mapping of the world, that there is parties that are fighting for some form of sovereignty, and I know that in some way the government of the government in South Korea has been talking about reunification as a real concept, obviously with zigs and zags of how different political parties see it, but it is a real question. Could you talk about what do you think are going to be the reactions to the recent elections in South Korea?
Well, one of the reasons why Noh Moo-hyun was targeted was that he stood for a much more open policy towards North Korea, towards dialoguing, towards trying to find ways for bringing the two governments closer together, but also bringing the people increasingly together. As you know, everyone in Korea, North and South and overseas, really sees it as one country. And so there's a lot of popular support for that, but of course the conservative parties weren't in favor of that. One of the positive things, you know, it is important to keep in mind the negative aspects of the Uri Party, the fact that there was a South Korea-Chile free trade agreement that passed under its rule, and that, you know, Lee Kyung-hae is not the only person who tried to commit suicide in protest of what's going on economically in South Korea under the Nomihan government. However, the fact that there are divisions within the Uri Party, that there are more progressives as well as moderates in the Uri Party, and the fact that the Democratic Labor Party has made such a strong showing means that there's potential for even more movement, and that there's really a voice there, and that if the DLP can leverage, the Democratic Labor Party can leverage its position and its votes to actually bring the Uri Party further in a more progressive direction, you know, that's very, very promising, both in Korea and globally, I think.
Well, this is also in response. What is the support? Obviously, the Democratic Labor Party got 10 seats, basically a fifth of the proportional representation votes. What is the role of the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions and some of the social movements, both in the colleges and the public sector? I know their response to the structural adjustment has been huge in the 80s and 90s, but what role have they played in the actual rise of the Democratic Labor Party?
Well, the president, as well as a lot of the people in the party, are actually members, you know, leaders of the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions. So they came out of a long history of progressive labor organizing and unionizing, and then decided that part of their movement had to look at the electoral process. So some years ago they formed the party, and there's still a, you know, very close connection between the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, which is the national union movement in South Korea, and the Democratic Labor Party.
You know, we had mentioned earlier that Nodato for Korean Development in New York City has been doing a lot of educational trips to North Korea and trying to do some political education and some consciousness raising around it. But you guys have also had a huge backlash, huge attacks of red baiting by conservative forces in New York. How can you describe what's happened, and how have you guys dealt with the issue of even trying to rally and work inside of the United States for reunification and for a more public support of self-determination on that peninsula?
Right. It's interesting now with all the talk about the Patriot Act in the United States. People are talking about it's a throwback to McCarthyism and so forth. But in South Korea, with the national security law, which actually was much more far-reaching than McCarthyism, it hasn't ended. It's been going on since the 50s, this kind of repression. It's a law that regards North Korea as an anti-state organization, and that any kind of, you know, you could have gotten thrown into prison in the past for owning a book, for talking about it, for saying something. It was really, really draconian. And in the early years of the existence of South Korea, people were actually killed. There were thousands upon thousands of leftists and progressives who were actually killed. And so that, with the very, very strong anti-communist education, has resulted in a South Korean population that, for the most part, is really fearful, often fearful, of speaking out or even asking questions or being open to North Korea. We don't go around saying you have to like North Korea or you have to support North Korea or you have to love everything about it. No, we say we have the right to ask questions. We have the right to find out. We have the right to ask and spread information. We have the right to talk about these things and have people really decide for themselves based on looking at what's really happening. And because of that alone, we've met with this incredible backlash from some members of the Korean community in New York City. You know, it's not, I don't think it's the majority. It's a vocal minority of the community, because when we talk to people, people are actually extremely supportive of what we do. We've never made a secret of our activities, and whenever we tell people, whether it's Korean immigrants or second-generation Koreans, they say they think it's a great idea. And it's just very unfortunate that some members still hold on to this really, sadly brainwashed notion that if you ask a question, that's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think this topic is really important, because even on, obviously, on the progressive and on the left, you get a lot of response of, you know, why are we in Iraq? We should be in North Korea. We should, you know, they're the ones with nuclear arms, and obviously that is the most chauvinist and, it's the most offensive thing I've heard in a long time. I mean, as far as one, you get a lot in the U.S. people acting and promoting U.S. In different countries, promoting that, you know, on a positive level, the U.S. government or NGOs could be any kind of a positive force, and what we're calling for, and obviously the show has important theme of the show is the right to self-determination. It's the right for oppressed people, both inside and outside the United States, to push it back. Can you talk a little bit about the role, what people can do here in the U.S. in order to open up more of this dialogue and continue to work towards one, finding out more information, and two, what can we do in terms of supporting unification?
Yeah, I think I'm really glad you brought it back to that, because that's really the crucial issue here. North Korea has said we have the right to defend our own country. You know, it just basically boils down to that. Most people in the United States forget that the United States identified North Korea as a possible target of first strike nuclear attack. That means, in the Nuclear Posture Review, which was released in January of 2002, the U.S. said we're going to identify North Korea along with some other countries as potential targets for not defense but first strike nuclear attack. And the DPRK responds by saying, no, you're not going to attack us, and we have every right to defend ourselves. Now, if the U.S. is saying you've got to dismantle all of your weapons, and then maybe we'll consider what we'll do next. The DPRK is sitting there looking at Iraq that did dismantle, and then look what happened to Iraq, right? So they have no incentive to dismantle what they see as the only thing standing between them and a U.S. invasion.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, Cheney and Rukers of London just stated that in a speech that he ruled North Korea as one, a tyrannical government, and thrived on terrorism, and then pointed to the fate of, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein for threatening the U.S. So here we go. I mean, a serious upping of the aggression towards North Korea, and so I think it's totally correct. Anything that we can do in order to push back our own government.
Right. Specifically, one thing that that people could do is, right now there's in Congress a couple of bills. One is called the North Korean Freedom Act of 2003, and the other is the North Korean Human Rights Act of 2004. And under the guise of support for human rights, it's really another form of of course we support human rights, and I think that, you know, anyone should support refugees in any situation, right? Should provide humanitarian aid to refugees and so forth. But there's really a fear on the part of a lot of activists, both in South Korea and the United States, that the North Korean Freedom Act and the North Korean Human Rights Act are actually intended to sort of open up North Korea further, to put more pressure on North Korea to, up the kind of discourse and rhetoric against North Korea. And so we're really urging people to look very carefully at what these acts are doing, and if you don't support it, to really call your congresspeople and let them know that this is not necessarily progressive, this is not leading to a de-escalation, and this could actually make the situation worse.
Thank you so much, Sung-hae. And can you give our listeners some information on where they could get on Notital? Do you have a website or anything
sure.
that they can?
Our website is www.notutor.com, and it's spelled NODUTDOL.com.
Thank you so much, Sung-hae. And we'll be right back with Phyllis Kim from One Korea LA Forum to talk about unification work here in Los Angeles.